You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good afternoon to all of you, and particularly the Diplomatic Corps, which seems to have turned out in force and in great distinction. Kristalina Georgieva, our speaker this afternoon, has an important title and an important institution. She is the European Commission's Vice President for Budget and Human Resources. But she has given me permission to veer a little bit from what that set of phrases means. The last phrase, human resources, has taken on a different and very much in a minor key meaning in today's world and today's Europe. She and her fellow European leaders are dealing with a crisis in the human resources of two regions of the world. That is the massive wave of refugees escaping from the Middle East in hopes of finding safety in Europe. And no doubt she will address that issue in her remarks. And her experience and credentials make her a particularly timely person to be talking to us on that set of issues. Her career includes 23 years working on development and humanitarian policy. I had a chance to meet her when she was working in that field when she was at the World Bank, and she obviously, as was apparent a couple of minutes ago, a very good friend of our colleague, Kamal Dervish, here at the Brookings Institution. So we look forward to hearing her perspective on Europe's role in an increasingly turbulent world and the steps that it can take to ensure, I might even say, salvage a secure and violent and vibrant future for Europe. I should also mention that this series of lectures is made possible by Alan and Jane Batkin. It's called the International Leaders Forum. And thanks also to the EU and especially its delegation here in Washington for supporting our work on Europe here at the Brookings Institution. After she delivers her remarks, Jeremy Shapiro, my colleague from our foreign policy program here at Brookings, will moderate a Q&A. And you're all welcome to take out your cell phones as long as you use them to tweet this discussion. And that can be done with hashtag EUVP. So, Kristalina, welcome to Brookings, and thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much for this very kind introduction, and many thanks to the ambassadors and everybody in the audience for taking time to come and engage with me today. I have chosen to talk about first the world and then Europe, because what is happening in Europe to a very great degree stems from what is happening in our neighborhood. And if you look at the world around us, very clearly there are wonderful positive changes. We have technology and innovation in transformative force. I'm told that actually when you read the medical journals, they say that advancements in medicine are such that we can live to be 120 today. I mean, those of us in the audience willing to do so may pursue it. And, of course, it sounds wonderful until you realize that we probably have to work until we are 110 to earn our pensions. It is, in terms of connectivity, ability to move ideas, goods and services, an incredible world. It is a very rich world. Even during the years of crisis, it continued to grow in size. Today, we have $75 trillion economy. And some of this has allowed the most vulnerable people on this planet to live better. In 20 years, 1 billion people moved out of poverty. But it is also a much more fragile world. We are much more prone to shocks, financial shocks, and they transfer very quickly. Climate change hitting us with a very big hammer and will continue to do so and more in the future. Conflicts, and they are of a kind that we are not so at ease to deal with. They are not the wars between nations where you can see a pathway forward. We suffer the force of violent extremism in a way that puts all of us to a test. And of course, we have much speedier transformation of good and bad. Trouble travels, as we now see it in Europe very clearly. All of this is not so well matched by our political capacity to cope. For us in Europe, we have to adjust. The rest of the world has to adjust. For us, this adjustment is more difficult for two reasons. One, we have lived through a couple of decades of wonderful times when the only direction for our union was to be bigger and to be better. And now we are, in the last years, limping from one crisis into another. We had the financial crisis turned into economic crisis. Then we had the Eurozone crisis, particularly affecting Greece. We were just climbing out of the Greek crisis, and we were hit by the refugee crisis. And in this contrasting time, when we went from very good to quite troubling, we are starting to forget how good it is to have the union and how much the union delivers for us. It is so difficult for us to remember that Europe is still an anchor of stability, and it is still the most vibrant regional body there is. The second reason it is somewhat difficult for us to adjust, and I will talk a little bit more about that later, is because we are still a young union, and we tend to forget about it. Think of the United States 65 years in its own history. I see here some friends from the States. Where were you guys? California out, Texas out, the dollar was not a national currency, and the Civil War was ahead of you, not behind. But you had the luxury of times when everything moved much slower. People traveled on horses. And now that luxury, I don't think we have anymore. And actually, I don't mind if you sit here and then take all the questions from this tough audience. In moving towards this process of adjustment to time of multiple shocks, for us in Europe, I think it is very important to be clear about our strengths and also about the risks we face. Our strengths. Well, first, our fundamentals, our economic fundamentals are strong. I enjoy listening to debates in which people say, which one is the biggest, the United States or China? Because we all know in Europe that so far and for some time to come, and hopefully it would be a long time in the future, we are the number one economy. We are the largest economy in the world. We have been adjusting to very difficult times, and now, although I would have liked us to do better, we got our fall forecast, and it says we continue in recovery, in our economic recovery. We continue 3 years in a row. All our economies are growing. Well, they're not growing as much as we would have liked them to grow, but in average we have 1.9% for 2015, 2% 2016, 2.1% 2017, and unemployment is accordingly being trimmed down. 9.5% 2015, 9.2% 2016, 8.9% 2017. And the reason we have been able to come out of the crisis, relatively speaking, in one piece, because of our size and the single market. They help us to absorb these shocks. Just a couple of years ago, people were saying, no way the euro would survive. Well, the euro survived. People were saying, no way Greece would be able to stay in the eurozone and even in the European Union. Greece is in the eurozone and the European Union. And the countries, and what is actually more important for me, is that the countries that have been most determined to undertake structural reforms, like Ireland, are doing very well. Same applies to Portugal. Let's see how the new political environment there would work for the Portuguese people. Same applies to Spain. Hopefully we would see the structural reforms in Europe continuing. Our second big strength, and we tend to forget it in these tough times, and I'll come to the toughness of times, is our best invention, the convergence engine. We have been able to lift up regions and economies in a way that has no precedence, no comparison in history. Out of the two dozen or so countries that have managed to jump from middle income status to high income status, the most difficult transition to make, half of them are in the European Union, and the other half either have oil or authoritarian regimes. So we have managed to do it in a democratic manner, no oil. The third big advantage of Europe, and I think it is one that we can be proud of, is we are the most equitable region in the world. My former employer, the World Bank, published a report in which they called the EU a lifestyle superpower. And I read it and I said, well, I don't know, you know, is this a good thing? After having lived in the United States and now I live in Europe, and I can vouch, yeah, it's kind of a good thing. But it is a good thing as long as we actually do it right. And we do have a lot of work to do in Europe to do it right. Yes, even during the time of crisis, our Gini coefficient in average has gone slightly down. In other words, we have continued on this road of less inequality. But there is a huge difference. The countries that have suffered most of the crisis have seen inequality growing. And we have a big problem because our social expenditures are simply not affordable. We have to trim them down, especially trim down pensions. Why? Not necessarily take money away from people, but get people to work a little longer if we want to continue to enjoy that advantage. We are attractive for our neighborhood. It is great to see some of the countries in the region that I hope one day would be in the European Union. Even if you think of the very, very tough events in Ukraine, if you think of the flow of refugees, people come to Europe. They aspire to be in Europe because Europe is a very good place to live. But I'm reminding all this not because I want to do kind of propaganda about Europe, but because I worry that we in Europe are so overwhelmed by the risks we face that we don't take the time to remember this strengths of our union. We do face today existential risks, and they are, in my view, there are two. The main of these risks are two. The first one is, it is the most visible and the most urgent. It is the refugee crisis. Since it started, we are seeing a very significant swing upward of Euroscepticism again. During the years of the economic crisis, Euroscepticism went up. Then we started coming out of the crisis, it went down, and now we see it being boosted again. Like the financial crisis and the economic crisis, it clearly shows, this refugee crisis clearly shows the limitations of an incomplete union. The financial crisis tested the euro. The refugee crisis tests the free movement of people. And for many of us in Europe, the free movement of people is the most precious thing we have. I can tell you when my country became a member of the European Union, the very first time I crossed the border under the sign of for EU citizens, it was in Frankfurt Airport, I crossed it and I cried. And I think about it and I can cry again, because for us, especially on the eastern part of Europe, this is so precious to be together, to be one union. Now, I was Commissioner for Humanitarian Aid. 2 years ago, I was in the neighborhood of Syria. I came back and I wrote a blog, and the title of the blog was Trouble Travels. And it was about the explosion of refugees, and that unless we find a way to put an end to this madness in Syria, or at least care much more about the neighboring countries, this is going to come and hit us in Europe. It's like a slow-moving tsunami. And yes, it came and it is hitting us. We have to be fair to Europe on one point. I do not think there is a region or a country on this planet that can receive about a million people, and not be shaken by that. So we should not say, oh, look at the Europeans, they cannot cope. But we do have to think about the consequences, and we need to think about what it means for Europe if we want to overcome these risks. What it means for Europe is a tremendous difficulty of our member states to identify and adopt easily a common approach to what is clearly a common problem. The crisis is forcing us to address a very simple question. How could 28 different approaches to migration be brought under the same umbrella? How to do that? And the way we are dealing with it is twofold. One is operational, save lives and help with the flow of arrivals. And of course, the second one is structure policy that would allow us to cope in the future. On the operational side, there are four big things we are doing. One, to mobilize human resource capacity, to mobilize people with the skills that can be deployed very quickly on the route of arrival of refugees. So there could be fast registration and relatively quickly separation of those that are refugees from those that are illegal migrants, that are not running away from war. Secondly, to help our countries with reception capacity. We just had, 10 days ago, a decision to create additional 100,000 reception capacity, so when people come, especially during the winter, they have a place to go. Third, to help our member states in sharing this flow of people. I can tell you this is very difficult. We have taken a decision for 160,000 people to be relocated across the European Union, those that come in the two main entry points, Italy and Greece. It is moving very slowly. Moving slowly mostly because we have to be sure that when people go somewhere, they actually stay there. and they don't run back to mostly Germany and Sweden. And that is not an easy thing to do. And the fourth area where we are working with our member states is to execute some harmonization of return policy. We have started sending people back to countries, to safe places. This is very important, not because we Europeans are cruel and we don't understand that to run from war and to run towards better conditions of life are both understandable goals. We understand that. But unless we manage to demonstrate to our public that refugees are one category, illegal migrants are a different category, and we can handle them differently, there is a huge risk of the European public becoming very negative and hostile to the people who are running for their lives with their kids in hands, as we have seen many, many pictures. So this is on the operational side, saving lives, making sure that we have ships in the sea to rescue people from boats that sink. And then capacity to deal with this flow of people within Europe. A lot, very tough job, a lot to do. And then we have the policy side. On the policy side, there are two very critical packages that we are putting together. One we hope to have by the end of this year, and it is on border control, to make sure that we have a common approach to our external borders. And the second one for the spring of next year on revamping the so-called Dublin regulation. This is what defines who is a refugee and who is not, and how you treat refugees. One of the toughest questions for us would be uniform application of social benefits. Obviously, I should say, uniformity is a very difficult thing. We have now a situation when if you go in the Netherlands, in 8 days, you are kind of processed and you are either accepted to be a refugee, processed as a refugee or not. You go to France, it may be a year, and then you can go and challenge it in court, and it would be a much longer period of time. Big differences in what people are entitled to. In Germany, they would have 400 euros plus free lodging. In my country, Bulgaria, they would get 300 levered. This is an equivalent of 150 euros. That's it. Guess where people would want to be? So this is all work that is excruciatingly difficult. We, on top of it, have a situation in which the new member states have very little exposure to anything of that nature, and the old member states feel that solidarity for new member states is turning into one-way street. You show us solidarity, but we don't want to do the reciprocity. It's a little more complicated than that, but it is a very serious issue. And this whole complex of issues sometimes risks us to do a huge mistake, and it is to concentrate on the 1 million people that are in Europe and forget about the 59 million refugees that are outside of Europe. And that, for us in Europe, is a critical issue to be able to sustain and actually make much more strategic our action as a soft power, to engage strategically with countries in conflict and their surrounding, to help people sustain their lives and actually have some hope for the future, and to help the countries that are hosting them on a major scale. And I can tell you, I was humanitarian aid commissioner, so I have some background on that. I'm actually now co-chairing a high-level group on humanitarian finance. I'm very worried that if we only look at the problem at home is going to continue to grow. If we don't help people where they are, the massive movement is going to continue, and we are closest to those who suffer war and destruction. We are the closest safe haven for them. But this is only one of the two big risks for Europe. The second one, I don't think, is less important. And it is the necessity for us to accommodate in one and the same union those who want to deepen the integration and those who want to have a lesser degree and even, you know, even go a little softer on what we currently have. This is being now put front and center to us with the British referendum. And it is absolutely paramount for the UK to stay in, but it is also paramount for us to continue to develop as a union, to define for both groups equal fair treatment. So what does it mean in practical terms? I mean, the facing these existential risks, what does that mean for us in the European Union? Well, first, it puts to the test our leadership, and it puts to the test us in the European Commission. And I can tell you we are determined to pass. For the Commission, and I was a member of the previous Commission, so I can make comparison. For this Commission, there are two ingredients that are quite different. It is a much more political Commission, and it is a more focused Commission. We have determined a set of priorities, 10 priorities. Migration, by the way, is one of the 10 priorities. And we stick to concentrating our resources and our attention to those priorities. And if I were to group them to say, you know, what are those, and actually I have to group them because my job is to make sure that our budget and our people are aligned with these priorities. First, it is first and foremost for us is to deal with crisis, to deal with crisis even when they overlap. We have to learn this. It is not an easy task to do. And I can tell you we are not, I mean, I don't think human race is actually very good at dealing with multiple crises. I mean, kind of, we are like 8-year-olds playing soccer. And here is the ball, we are all with the ball, and then it moves and we go after it. And we have to learn to play soccer as adults. Secondly, for us it's absolutely essential as Commission to inject stimulus for growth, because we can deal with all this crisis much better if our economy is stronger. And in this respect, there are two things we do that are very interesting, very exciting. You don't hear much about them because the shadow of crisis actually hides it. One is broadening and deepening the internal market. The internal market has been our most significant strength, our most significant source of competitive advantage. So what we're doing now, we are deepening it in the area of energy with the energy union. Very important to bring costs down and also to increase the capacity of us to be more secure in terms of energy supplies. And we are broadening it with the digital market and with the capital union. And then on top of it, what we have is a very significant shift in how we use our budget, and that's my job. And dobar den to the Bulgarian ambassador. Very, very nice to see you here. Yes.
Everybody will know that I'm late, sorry.
Well, but the important thing is that you are here, so that's wonderful. And actually, the ambassador and I had the chance to meet already, so this is, I didn't expect to see her, so courtesy, thank you. The second thing we are in that context of pushing more growth in Europe is straight in my alley, and it is how we can use the European budget to bring in more private sector investments. Normally, the European budget, it's about 150 billion a year, is distributed as grants. Well, there are many things for which grants are wonderful, but there are things for which grants are not the right instrument. So we are taking a portion of the budget to use it as a guarantee fund so we can crowd in private investor. We can unleash the potential of our liquidity in the banking sector, currently sleeping, doing nothing for us. We have a very strong commitment to what we call better regulation. Take out red tape from our economy. Make sure that what we regulate, we absolutely ought to regulate at European level, and do this regulation in a more competitive with fast-moving changes in the economy manner. And as you know, here in the United States, a huge, huge focus for us is TTIP, to make sure that we have the transatlantic investment partnership, trade and investment partnership with the United States as a boost for growth. And the third priority, surprise you, is to work on the economic and monetary union, and that is to say to strengthen the Eurozone. This de facto means to work on a two-speed Europe, to create more integration for the Eurozone, common currency, deeper integration, and then make sure that this does not affect the place and role of non-Eurozone member states. The second big issue for us is to step up our engagement with the neighborhood, both on the east and on the south. And I can tell you that things that were in the beginning of our term sort of not very front and center are coming right there, relations with Turkey. We are neighbors, we are interdependent. But we have been kind of shying away a little bit from translating this into more active engagement with Turkey. Serbia, the ambassador of Serbia is here. And we know each other from the past. Serbia is a candidate country that aspires to join the European Union. We have been sort of saying, well, you know, no expanding within the mandate of this commission. But now we see how critical it is for the Western Balkans to have a coordinated, integrated approach. What does it mean in our engagement? Ukraine. What and how we can do with Ukraine to make sure there is more stabilization. But most importantly, and I am repeating myself, but it is so important for us, for Europe to use our soft power in regions of instability in a much more strategic and determined manner. We are 20% of the world economy, 50% of development aid and humanitarian assistance. It ought to be working harder to bring fragilities down. We want to see a European engagement on peace building and peacekeeping more actively, especially on peace building. And we are, last but not least, for us in Europe, success in climate action is a massively important priority. Because we believe it is a huge threat. We believe we can have a carbon neutral economies not too far in the future. And because the refugee crisis has brought front and center the risk we all face of climate refugees. The IPCC tells us that by 2025, the climate refugees would hit 100 million. Okay. Where is the climate impact most severe? It is in the belt of trouble, mostly in our neighborhood. Start from Sahel, the Horn of Africa. So out of this 100 million, there would be many that maybe also looking up to Europe for their future. And of course, the thing about climate refugees is that we actually don't know whether there wouldn't be some of us in this category. So when we talk about building solidarity for a future world, it is also in our own self-interest to do so. Finally, the role of the United States. In Europe, we are very keen to see more engagement and more interest from the U.S. towards Europe, especially when we have this turbulent time. We need you. We need the United States, not only to finalize the, hopefully not too far in the future, the trade agreement, but we need a strategic alliance because you are our brothers and sisters and cousins in terms of values. With you, we feel most comfortable to do what we do in the world. We count on you to work together on stabilizing the Middle East. Without it, this refugee crisis that we face today would look like child play 2-3 years down the road. And of course, we need to have a consolidated standing with U.S. on global affairs. I want to finish with the following. Europe's problems, the refugee crisis, the tension between national sovereignty and regional integration, climate change, security. These are not just Europe's problems. These are global problems. They are a tall order to solve. And then this brings to mind one of my favorite stories. When you have problems of tall order to solve, how do you solve them? And the answer is there are two ways to solve them. One is realistic, and the other one is fantastic. The realistic is extraterrestrials come from space, take over human affairs, they fix it for us. And the fantastic is we people do it ourselves. And so I want to conclude by saying that actually collaboration, us working together, it may make the fantastic realistic, switch the places in this solution. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for that very wide-ranging and even passionate speech. We don't get that very often here, and it's really appreciated. And certainly the image of an 8-year-old soccer game is one that's going to haunt my perspective on government meetings from forever, I think. So we really appreciate that. I think what I'd like to do is ask you one or two questions and then take it to the audience so that you can engage with the Vice President. And so please think about your questions. When I come to the audience, it would be great if you could, before asking your question, identify yourself, especially if you're an ambassador. And also make sure that you actually ask a question and that it ends in a question. I've already fended off one challenge to my moderation, as you may have noticed, and I will do more. So you alluded in your speech to the importance of solidarity. You said that European solidarity is one of its principal strengths, and the fear that it might break down is one of the principal threats. I wanted to push you a little bit on something that you mentioned in your speech as a particular threat to solidarity, and that's what appears to be an East-West or a new member state, old member state divide that's opened up over the refugee crisis. I think for those of us here in the United States, this is perhaps a little bit surprising to be seeing the Eastern member states particularly so strong and fierce in their resistance to taking in refugees. I'm wondering if you can explain to us why this is happening, why it's a threat to EU solidarity, and what you as a commissioner, what you as the EU Commission can do about it.
Where is the lady that was taking this chair? This is actually an excellent question, and it goes
goes back in my own experience, 2013. Bulgaria, my own country, was the first one to feel this flare of the Syrian war at home. We got all of a sudden from a couple of people to tens to hundreds crossing from Turkey into Bulgaria. Bulgaria, for those who may not know, is a very traditionally hospitable place. When we had the horrible stories of Armenians running from their lives from Turkey, they were welcomed in Bulgaria, and many of them today call Bulgaria home. During the Second World War, when everywhere the Jewish people were sent to their death in camps, Bulgaria, an ally of Germany in the war, refused to let our Jewish people go. We stood for them. So my expectation was that people running for their lives would find the same hospitable environment in Bulgaria. And to my shock, that did not happen. It didn't happen for a number of reasons, and these reasons are very clearly visible in the new member states today. One, we do live in a new world where the scary, ugly head of terrorism is for everybody to see. And people very genuinely are afraid what is coming. They are afraid of the unknown, and fear has big eyes. They're afraid that that may be horrible things coming. Secondly, there is a degree of populism that jumps on everything like this to say, ha, I can harvest some voters out of this. So bombarding in a fairly deteriorating media environment, bombarding people with all kinds of stories. Oh, they're going to change our culture. These are people who are not like us. Hate them, hate them, hate them. And this spreads very, very unfortunately spreads. And then the third reason is very, very significant. We have seen less fuel in this convergent engine I talked about. So the distance between the richer parts of Europe and the poorer parts of Europe is not shortening as fast as it used to. So people really feel that they are poor. Why should they be paying for others? And if anybody is to be paying for them, it should be the Germans. Right, I actually wrote the first op-ed I wrote when that happened was solidarity is a two-way street. And I still believe it and I stand by that. Solidarity is a two-way street. But it has been difficult, and I see it now in other countries in Eastern Europe. I see this phenomenon of this combination, kind of a poisonous cocktail of legitimate fears and then populism and then hater, they all come together and they create a genuine public discontent. Now, can we live with that? No, because solidarity is the bread and butter of the European Union. But how do we cope with this? And my answer to this is we really have to talk to each other. Even if we don't agree, we have to talk with each other, not past each other. I'm very much afraid that some of the voices in that context legitimately saying, you know, what are you doing? We are helping you. Now we need you to step in. You're nowhere to be seen. That rather than trying to build the unity are saying, okay, you don't want to be to show solidarity. We don't want to show solidarity with you anymore. So there is cohesion funding. It's a big part of our budget. Maybe we should take this cohesion funding away. This would be a colossal mistake, because eroding the union is what would make our problem bigger. It is not going to shrink it. So using our we have to have the maturity of judgment to overcome these difficulties, to show some patience towards each other, and more than anything else, to trust the very simple truth of life. Together we are stronger. So we have to stick together. And these are problems we can only address sticking together.
Together we are stronger. Let's expand that out a little bit. You also mentioned that transatlantically, I guess, together we are stronger, and that the United States is an important partner. I'm wondering a little bit more specifically what you want and think the United States can and should do about the refugee crisis, which you mentioned is not actually a European refugee crisis, it's a global refugee crisis.
I would have three pleas for the United States. The first plea is love and care.
Well, could you ask us anything else?
We are the post-Second World Europe. Is your child. It has grown to maturity. You have economic interest of us being a strong economy, because we are actually right now, I think the European stocks are slightly undervalued because everybody says, oh, what's going on in Europe? I think we would in the end come out a bit well. But this is the first one. You know, don't be with us. We share so much. My second point is U.S. Engagement in stabilization of the most fragile states. As a long-time development professional, I very strongly believe that we have to concentrate official development assistance on situations of fragility. We do not have the luxury to spread the butter on a big piece of bread equally. We have to concentrate, and we need U.S. For that. And third, geopolitically, we need U.S. To work on peace process first and foremost, Syria. Glimpse of hope. With the Vienna meeting, glimpse of hope. We need U.S. there.
And expanding that concept of solidarity even out further, I know that you're also, you wear many hats, and you're also on the, and I think you're also in the United States for the UN High-Level Panel on Humanitarian Financing. And we've been very concerned here at Brookings of what my colleague Beth Ferris has called a crisis in the in the global UN humanitarian system. I'm wondering if you can tell us what role that needs to play and what you're doing on that high-level panel to fix it.
Thank you for this question. Now, imagine that people in need of humanitarian assistance were a country. If they were a country, today they would have been the 11th largest country in the world, just between Japan and Mexico. What we have seen is an exponential increase of humanitarian needs. People in this country, half of them would be displaced. They would, for no fault of their own, they would be having no homes. Majority of the adult people in this country would not be working. They would be depending on our generosity to survive. And majority of the children, especially girls in this country, would not go to school. So what we have is a huge problem that we have been complacent about. It has grown. This country was 4 times smaller in year 2000. In year 2000, we spent $2 billion on humanitarian aid. In year 2014, we spent $25 billion. And the distance between the needs and the money we put has grown significantly. And why it is important to actually take the humanitarian system and change it? Because on top of it, the duration people spent in displacement has increased enormously. Now it is 17 years. And yet we continue to treat people in displacement as if they're there for 3 months and they're going to go home. You know, give them water, give them food, and that's it. So we need a very massive transformation of bringing development and humanitarian aid together, major reform in that regard, actually bringing the fund in that picture, to think about how you build fiscal space to deal with shocks. What you do to help fragile states to build a tax base so they can actually come out of fragility. So the interesting point here is that we will come from the humanitarian financing panel, but we would make recommendations that go way beyond just raising more money. How use the money, how you build long-term engagement when the situations are long-term in fragility. We would be very demanding on both the donors and the humanitarian organizations. To be very honest, we are all failing the people of this country. The donors have to harmonize their requirements. They have to simplify these requirements. They have to provide a longer-term money, predictable money. And they have to decrease the earmarking that makes it so very difficult to make efficient use of money. And the humanitarian organizations, they have to grow up. It is no more a $2 billion business in which it's still very big, but in which every organization has their own headquarters, cost structure, modus operandi. They don't talk to the development people because, you know, these are two different worlds. That has to change. Seeing what $10 can do to save a life, to save a kid's life. I always say development money, all money is very valuable, but humanitarian money is like gold. And today we have gold that is part of it, 9-carat gold. You take $1, put it in the system, 40 cents go to the end beneficiary. And some of this is 24-carat gold. You have a dollar, 95 cents goes to the end beneficiary. So we have to move, we have to have the discipline to move our goal to be a 24-carat goal. And that takes very serious systemic change.
Thanks. I don't think I've seen anybody so anxious to answer one of my questions before. So I think that's a challenge to the audience to ask questions that will motivate her as well. So why don't we take some questions from the audience? There's one here in the third row.
Hello, thank you for an excellent presentation so far. I'm going to. Barbara Matthews, BCM International Regulatory Analytics. Building on the two questions that you have asked, the Commission in the last few days published their agenda for the G20 summit, which is coming up. And at the beginning of that agenda is a request that the G20 address the migration situation. Mm-hmm. Will some of your ideas regarding humanitarian aid be part of that agenda? What would you like the global community as represented in the G20 to do? Are you hopeful, in fact, they will rise to the challenge this weekend?
Do you want to take a couple of questions or you answer
one
to one?
Why don't you go ahead and answer it?
Okay. I'm sure that there would be some discussion around how we raise more funding to help people and the countries that are hosting them in the main regions of crisis. But I don't expect very deep discussion on what I just presented very shortly. I expect this discussion to take place in Istanbul in May during the World Humanitarian Summit. But I can tell you one thing, that you're bringing a very important point. Our panel, which is, by the way, a very interesting group of people, our panel, after doing our work, concluded that it cannot be just this one straight shot. We go from here to the humanitarian summit. Here is a report. Thank you very much, and bye. That we have to engage with the leadership. We are reaching out to the big countries, the biggest countries, both kind of traditional and emerging market countries. We are reaching out to different groupings, And we are saying this, the humanitarian part of it is just the tip of the iceberg. You have to look at the totality of this fragility and then build a response that is a more comprehensive response than just worrying about spending better the humanitarian piece of it. So hopefully the G20 is going to have some discussion around it, but over time we have to internalize this question of fragility and deal with it as global community systematically.
Oh, okay, and the gentleman in the glasses.
Paul Witte, student of George Washington University, but also from Germany. My question is that, so I agree with all of the diagnosis which you've said, but I don't feel that you have a proper prescription for it. I don't feel that our leadership of Europe is doing enough. Like if we are feeling the European crisis right now in sense of refugees, that the countries in which the flows of refugees is going through, they are not cooperate with each other. Like when we hear Viktor Orban, who is saying that it's not a European problem, it's a German problem, and Germans should solve it. I don't feel that our leadership is doing enough in this crisis. And I know that I'm asking you for, like, to solve unsolvable, because it looks like, even like the Syrian problem is more complex than you have told, because we have the impact of Russia right now. Like, you are not in a very good position. Like, whole Europe is not in a very good position to solve that crisis. And I'm asking myself, what shall we do more?
You know, I agree with you. First, it is a very complex problem indeed. If you start talking about the Syria war and what causes the war and what needs to be done to bring the flares of war down and ask ourselves why that hasn't been done earlier, why we allowed for 5 years to go on. It's a big conversation we can spend the rest of the evening. And of course, you're right that it has been very difficult for us in Europe. But I'm a little more optimistic than you, because my experience, and that, you know, I have no problem for you and I in the end to agree to disagree, but my experience has been the following. We hear the negatives much more than we hear the positive things that are happening. The voice of hate, disagreement, very loud. The voice of goodness, very quiet. You look at Europe, and what is projected for everybody to see are these negatives, the clashes, the German problem, the, you know, it's somebody else's problem, not my problem. You hear this. What you don't hear, you don't see so much, is how much Europeans are doing to help these people and actually to try to cope communities. You see those that are revolting, saying, you don't want the refugees. But you don't see those that are accepting them. Where do these people go? I mean, this is a million arriving in matters of months. And we are hosting them. We are feeding them. We are trying to cope with this problem the best we can. Yes, our best is not good enough. But it will get better. I'm watching this in front of my eyes. It was very chaotic in the beginning. Now it is getting less chaotic. Now you have the professional teams arriving, registering refugees. Where you're right to worry is this accumulation of mutual accusations and mistrust? Is there a tipping point when trust is eroded? Solidarity is eroded so much that it would be difficult to overcome. And I would kind of throw the ball back to you. Kind of depends on us Europeans. And actually now friends in the United States, love and care. My big plea to Europe is believe in yourself. Because if we don't believe in ourselves, why would anybody else believe in us? And think of it, who we are, 507 million people, a million refugees on 507 million people. This is actually not so much. Think of Lebanon. Lebanon has 30% of its population being refugees. Lebanon is a very vulnerable country, and it is still holding. So a bit more standing power in Europe would do us a lot of good. And put pressure on our leadership. Stick together. You guys have to stick together. This is the boat we are in. And there is no way to say, for one country to say to another, hey, your side of the boat is sinking. We are all in it. Paddle, paddle, paddle.
Okay, can you just pass the microphone a couple rows back?
Yes, thanks. Mark Nichols from CSPIRE Advisors, a merchant bank. Do you think this crisis is going to make Europe become more active globally, or is it going to make Europe turn inward over time?
Well, you know, my hope is we would become more active globally. My fear is that we would focus on our belly button. And we have been a number of times in recent history very tempted to do the latter. And we cannot, we should not. I worry that we would start being tempted to call development funding what we spend to the refugees that are on our territory. Technically speaking, this is correct. But actually, we need to sharpen our generosity, lift it up, and concentrate more on helping people where they are. And this is perhaps where it is really important for us to work with our transatlantic partners, to work with the U.S., and work with the other friends we have, because it is important not to lose sight and to kind of drag Europe more to engage. I do believe that Europe does have a lot to offer as a soft power. We have been good at that. We have been trusted on many occasions. And I think a demanding, love and care, more of this would be very helpful in this moment of time.
Let's go to the front row and have the Bulgarian ambassador give her a question.
Thank you, Mr. Shapiro. You saved me the introduction. good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Vice President, for your intervention. I understand we are all doing refugees 24/7, but I would like to take you a little bit out of this particular subject and take you to a topic which is mid and long term for both the EU and America, and this is TTIP. I just got a very summarized review of the last round, and it looked quite positive to me. From what I understand, progress has been made in terms of tariffs. Some technical barriers, problems still remain, and of course, it is far from being moving to its final successful conclusion. But what are your thoughts on the mood in which the negotiation is going? Because we've got the Commission, which is obviously dedicated to moving the negotiation forward. At the same time, we have the European Parliament, which is a different political animal. Added the national parliaments to that. Do you think that a more consistent and convincing progress and interpretation of progress would help neutralize and bring down the fears, which sometimes may be legitimate, sometimes instigated? I would suspect some foreign influence in that popular reaction to TTIP. So just your thoughts on TTIP would be very welcome. Thank you.
You are right. It is, I mean, like many other subjects that we are dealing with in Europe, like the energy union or the digital market or the capital market, we talk so much about the crisis that we lose sight of some very important developments, and TTIP is one of them. On a technical level, there is really good progress, and we are going to have the next round of negotiations. Looks like we will continue in that constructive, positive spirit forward. But you put your finger on the most difficult part, and it is selling TTIP to our people. And there is a huge divergence of views. It's a little bit like, my professor of statistics used to say that you can put your feet in the refrigerator and your head in the oven, and your temperature would be average, but you are dead. So if you take our average, we are making good progress, but if you start unraveling it, some people have their head in the oven and some in the refrigerator. And it is a matter of actually a very serious concern that so much attention is now being grabbed by the urgent things that are in front of us that it is almost impossible to talk to our public, and our public is so stressed out from all these things, other things, that you don't even know what the reaction would be because of that. I'm a big fan on bringing strong voices from especially the business community to talk about the significance of TTIP for us, to bring those who understand the criticality for growth in Europe and benefits for the United States to speak more loudly. There is always a tendency for the naysayers to be very loud, and for those who are positive to say, oh yeah, I'm for, but not take the time to go out and explain it. And we have a lot of explaining to do. These are complicated matters. These are complicated matters. But if you can strip it down to the very basic anxieties and then try to destroy the myths, then you can make good progress. Take, for example, there was the myth that this is all secret. And I think we did a good job in destroying this myth. Everything is out there for people to see. But that's not the only one that is on the way of TTIP. I'm optimistic that we will make progress, whether it would be on a timeline to be completed with the within this administration in the U.S. I'm not that good of an expert to judge, but I can say that you are absolutely right to talk about the necessity of granulated engagement. Different audiences have different questions and different aspects of the problem they're interested in. We cannot have a kind of a one blanket communication strategy and hope that it is going to work for us.
Why don't we move back a little to in the center there on the left. Yeah, right there.
Thank you so much, Vice President. My name is Michelle Strzok. I'm from Oxfam America, and I wanted to thank you so much for your candid comments. One thing that struck me when you were speaking is this idea that a lot of your comments are about, in the face of the crisis that Europe is facing, how Europe needs to evolve, and on the humanitarian aid system and the links with development, how different actors in the system, including organizations like us, like Oxfam, need to evolve to be able to meet the changing needs. So we just released a report that you may have seen called Turning the Humanitarian System on Its Head. And mm-hmm, we argue, yep. Yes, and we argue that local actors are really one of the keys, empowering local actors so that they're taking on more leadership in terms of responses. So it's not always being parachuted in or being relied on by the EU or European or the US donors. So I wanted to ask you what you thought of the idea of channeling more funding directly to local actors as part of the solution for the future we want, and also just to ask you more about the links with development financing in terms of humanitarian recommendations. If you could talk a little bit more about what the U.S. could do to change some of the business model we have here of, you know, earmarked foreign aid to make it more effective and locally led. Thank you.
We, as humanitarian panel, we are still not quite clear what exactly we would say on moving funding faster and preferably directly to local organizations. I can tell you what I know we would say, and then what we don't, I don't yet know what we would say. What we know we would say is that today only 2% of humanitarian aid, international humanitarian assistance, goes directly to local organizations, and 2% is too little. But then what we would say what is, are we going to aim for some target? We are debating it. Some of us are in favor of saying it should be at least 10%, 15%. Some of us are saying these targets are very superficial. I mean, this category, it is more to define the engagement. And there, what we are going to demand from the humanitarian community is to be transparent on transaction and transaction costs. We want to see how many times a dollar turns from hands into hands to get to the end beneficiary. What is the role of local organizations in that? We also are going to recommend South-South partnership in that regard to get more credibility on financial accountability, because for many of us as donors, this is the difficult part. How do we know that money we give can be properly accounted for? We believe that we can enroll the big accounting companies to help with simple accounting processes, help to put something in place that help, that addresses this issue. On the link with development, we are putting some concrete recommendations forward for what should happen in the development community and what should happen in the humanitarian community, including some very specific institutional recommendations. For example, we believe that the soft lending grant facilities of development banks have to increase their role and absolute share. Either, for example, the International Development Association, this is the grant-giving soft loan facility of the World Bank, has opened up a crisis window. It has $900 million for 3 years. And in 1.5 years, this money is gone. So clearly not sufficient. So we are going to recommend how funding from the development side can be more engaged. But then we are also going to demand from the humanitarian community to be more upfront, building competence and skills to go beyond handouts, life-saving, to go into social safety nets, what you can do for job creation, how you link education to development in crisis situations. And some, I mean, Oxfam is a very good example because you're already doing that. You do bring the two sides of your activities more in sync. But that, as you know, is not yet universally the case. And then we would make recommendations for institutional cross-fertilization that you can monitor and follow. So it is not just the goodwill of a bunch of individuals, but there are institutional parameters of it. As for the U.S. so far is saying we are in, count us in. We do want to do harmonization and simplification and reduce earmarking. And then they, of course, then say, but you know our Congress. And that is a little bit like we have our parliament in the European Union. We all have our constraints. The question would be, can we put a roadmap that says we are here today and we are going to be there in a particular period of time? And then use the critical mass of a group of us, because the European Union and the United States together in humanitarian aid are around 75 to 80%. At our member states, the Commission and the U.S. So if we can clinch to each other and reinforce each other's commitment, it may happen. I mean, the only thing I can say here is the old Mandela saying, you know, it looks impossible until it is done. And done it must be.
Why don't we come back to the front row for another question?
Thank you, Madam Vice President, for a very enthusiastic testimony, and I think that all our European leaders should have that kind of confidence and self-confidence, because that's part of the solution. My question, we have been speaking a lot, I'm the Belgian ambassador, by the way, we have been speaking a lot about the migration issue, and I must say I agree with the thrust of what you said, that is that we can be excused to some extent for the way we handle that. This is something entirely new. We're speaking about 1 million people coming over in less than 8 months. And it's normal. We didn't have the instruments. We had to invent them as the problem arose. And I think we are rather managing well. So on that, I would say we can be more or less excused. But I don't think we can be excused in all fields of European policy. And I would like to question you on that. It's a kind of SWOT analysis, strengths and weaknesses. Perhaps that you could tell us a little bit what you see as the intrinsic weaknesses of the European Union. But I think just one point. We are now slightly recovering, and you gave some of the percentage points, 1.7 growth and that kind of things, unemployment going down slightly. But what you already see at this stage is that the discipline that we had just 2 years ago is already fading away. I was just reading what Dijsselbloem yesterday said, and that he feels like we need a separate objective committee to watch how people are behaving, the countries are behaving, as far as their fiscal policies are concerned. The banking union, which was so much in the lift just 4 years ago, 3 years ago, is now basically in a standstill. So, and this is within our purview. That is not something for which we can be excused. We have the political instruments and we have the political agenda to do that. So my question is, although I fully share your confidence and I would speak in all fora as you do, but what would you see as things that we have to address? Thank you.
You know, I think that for us in Europe, there is a very basic question, and it is either we work more and more productively, or we have to learn to live with less. There is no magic here. And more productively doesn't mean working long hours. I mean more productively. We have to look at our productivity across Europe and have the honesty to say that we are not where we should be. We are still only 2/3 to 3/4 of U.S. productivity, by and large. You know, we have exceptions in Europe. We have areas that are doing better. And that cannot be satisfactory for us. We have to be much more disciplined on aiming high in R&D. We have some countries, I'm thinking of Finland, parts of Germany, where this is really at par with best practice in the world. But then I'm going back to the oven and the refrigerator. You go to places where this is so pathetic, I don't want to even look at the numbers. And that, to me, is the same problem with banking union, with fiscal discipline. We have to take these things very seriously. The world is not going to give us a time pass on our leisure to catch up with competitive forces elsewhere. And to me, actually, the big worry is that the refugee crisis, as serious as it is, it's very serious and it is rightly a priority, but it kind of takes our eye away from the main objective, and we have to be a competitive region. We know that there is a particular problem in Europe. We don't like to talk much about it, but it is a very serious problem, and it's our demographics. Actually, the refugee problem should be helping us to pay out pensions in the future, if we handle it well, if we handle it well. The demographics of Europe is a problem of itself because all the populations tend to be more conservative, more set in their way, more difficult to create this sense of, yes, we can, you know, move forward. And that, if I were to say what is the big problem for us in Europe is the ability to create more dynamism, to actually embrace youthful populations and try to integrate them as quickly as possible, and not to forget that the short and the long for Europe is we have to be more competitive. We have to be more competitive. If you allow me to tell you an anecdote from my first months coming from East Coast United States to Brussels as a commissioner, accidental commissioner. Yeah, I'm not saying this is a good thing, but my reality, I saw a couple of former colleagues from the World Bank. Well, it's a 12-hour day, and, you know, Saturday and Sunday occasionally are weekends, and normally they kind of are not. So I come to my office in Brussels, and I called my team, and I said, let's see how we plan the year. What we need to deliver the year, and then you walk backwards, what needs to happen by when. So they say, great idea, run away, came back with a calendar. You know, this that you open it. They opened up this calendar 12 months, and I look at it, and there are these red spots on it. What's this? Oh, this is Easter holiday, summer holiday, Christmas, and a bunch of Belgian holidays. Like this week, by the way. And I said to myself, yeah, it's very interesting. So we planned our work around our vacations. You kind of expect that people plan their vacations more or less around this. This, in parts of Europe, and these are the more competitive parts of Europe, has changed. There is flexibility, agility, focus, but not everywhere. And I think we as Europeans, we have to say, you know, it's wonderful to have the accordion, you know, the red spots. But maybe we would be a healthier place if we kind of shrink them a little.
That's what it means to be a quality of life superpower, I think.
You know, this is wonderful to be a quality of life superpower. But if we can emphasize on forward-moving motion on that, means also to protect that quality of life, we kind of have to work a little more and more productively. Yeah.
Okay, we just have a few minutes left, so let's gather up a couple of questions, and you can have one final shot at it right here in the fourth row. Do you have a question?
I think you had a question in the first.
No? Any more questions? Yeah, in the back.
Thank you, Madam Vice President. It's actually nice to hear optimism of Brussels. Philippe Massensier from McLarty Associates. I just want to come back to something you've mentioned a couple of times this afternoon, love and care from this country for Europe. You mentioned the Vienna meetings. Actually, the U.S. was there. Europe wasn't. The French came in, a week after. Not talking about Iran, I'm talking about Syria. I'm just wondering how the richest economy in the world, according to what you were saying, an area of 470 million people, has to wait on the Russians, the Americans, the Iranians, and whoever else to start getting real about something which is happening right next to us. And how this actually has a huge impact on the people of Europe believing or not believing that the EU is good and can help us move forward.
Well, fact check. Federica Mogherini was there. So I absolutely do not agree that we were absent. We were there. Second fact check. You look at this madness of this conflict. And in terms of consistency of financial commitment to people affected, by far, Europe has been the most reliable. We have provided 4.2 billion euros to the countries in the neighborhoods to help with the needs of the Syrian refugees. So I don't know where you're, and we are very keenly interested in a solution. I don't know where your perception comes that we are absent. We, the EU, the Commission, we don't have planes and we don't have ships. But when it comes down to engagement, diplomatic engagement, we are there. Now, there is a very serious open question. Is Europe carrying its weight when it comes down to expenditures in defense, investment in defense? And it is true that some of our member states have not been sufficiently forthcoming, those that are especially NATO members, to meet their 2% of GDP target for military expenditures. But if you are objective and fair to contributions to stability, what we don't fund as defense, we fund as development aid and humanitarian aid. So financially, it is hard to say the Europeans are ducking responsibility. It is just that we have not been building certain areas of strength. And I would agree with you, this is where I would agree with you, that the world has changed. And when we look at the situation in Ukraine, is it enough to deal with this situation as a soft power, given that there is military threat? So we do have to revisit that in Europe. I think, and I also would agree with you very much that we have to be more systematically present, take more to heart an engagement, especially in our two neighborhoods, the eastern neighborhood and the southern neighborhood. Certainly that is a well-received message, and I would say well-received by majority of people in position of responsibility in Europe.
Well, I don't think that we can speak for the entire United States, but I can assure you that you will always have love and care coming from the Brookings Institution. We really appreciate your coming here. We really appreciate your passion and your informative speech, and please join me in thanking the Vice President. Thank you.